Accession number 27807, Mr. Harry Hooper, Real 8. Now, anything else about 1651, or would that be about it for them?
I think that's about it. Nothing really untoward happened. The aircraft was a delight to fly. I liked it. I could handle it. The crew were happy. We were all set to go.
So let's look at, I think we'll look at, because we look at a typical raid. I mean, you did three or four raids here. So we'll pick up the Hambing characteristics in action during our story of a typical raid. So what was your posting to?
I joined 115 Squadron, or we joined 115 Squadron, at Wychford, 2 or 3 miles west of Ely in Cambridgeshire.
And what were your first impressions on joining 115 Squadron of the nature of the unit and the base? You joined in March.
Yes. Beginning of March. Wychford was a typical RAF wartime bomber command station. A triangular system of runways, Nissen huts dotted around the far perimeters. Long walks to the mess, to the flight areas. Aircrew weren't allowed bicycles. We had to keep fit by walking. But the ground staff had bicycles.
What was your accommodation like?
The accommodation was in Nissen huts. There were, I believe, 8 beds to the hut, at least in the officers' huts. My bomb aimer and I, being commissioned, were in a hut. We had 2 beds, and there were a further 6 chaps in there.
Was it sort of open, or was it partitioned?
Oh, no, just an open, long hut, like a hospital ward.
And what sort of space did you have, and what personal, where would you put your personal possessions?
You had a small bed. These were, well, I call them RAF beds. They were just 2'6" wide, 6'6" long, I suppose. 3 biscuits. They were, each was a third of a thin mattress, blankets, sheets, a small locker at the side of the bed. There were hooks around the entrance. The entrances were double, i.e. there was a small porch built either inwards or externally from the entrance door for blackout reasons. So you entered one door, closed the door behind, and then entered the next door and closed that. In the middle of these, they had a small stove, which if you had any coke, you could light to warm up. But you can imagine what the fen area was like in winter. Bitterly cold, bitterly damp. And as we were officers, we never got any coke. The NCOs, being better scroungers, and nearer the coke dump, always had plenty of coke and always had a big fire going, whereas we had nothing. Stanley and I, being the commission person, once we had reported in, it was evening, we were allocated 2 beds in this hut. Thereafter, we went to the mess, got a meal, had a few beers.
Now, tell me about your reception. I mean, you're coming in, you're a new crew, but I presume new crews were coming in and leaving, you know.
Yes, all the time.
What sort of reception was there for you? I mean, how did they treat you? How did they brief you?
From the station, we rang 115 Squadron Adjutant. Didn't get the adjutant. We got an NCO who said, I'll send a Gary for you, sir. Gary being a truck and lorry, which they did. And we were dumped at the sort of adjutant's office, flight offices. And an NCO took myself and Stanley Bomaimer to our quarters. Another NCO took my 5 NCOs to their quarters. And we were told we'd have to report to the flight office or the squadron office the next morning. I do remember this because the first night Stan and I returned to our billet, we woke up. The billet wasn't full in any case. There were just 2 other people occupying it from ourselves. And when we woke up, we're getting dressed, having got some cold water to washing and the ablutions. When we got back into the hut, there was an NCO there collecting kit and gear from the other two beds and the lockers. And it quickly became obvious that these two chaps hadn't got back, returned. It wasn't that they were missing, they had apparently been killed. We didn't know for sure at the time. And that was that. So that was our first introduction to the squadron. I might add that 115 had the heaviest casualties of all Bomber Command's squadrons during the war.
Now, were you aware of that then?
No, I wasn't. And it wasn't during that period they were suffering very badly, but they had suffered. They carried out the most Wellington raids of any bomber squadron. They dropped more bombs from Wellington's any other squadron. And overall, I think they were second in total weight of bombs dropped by any squadron in Bomber Command.
Now, what was
they were in existence at the beginning of the war. Had been reformed, so they'd had a long, hard war.
Now, what happened when you went to the squadron office, to report in?
Well, we went to the squadron office and were told we had been allocated to B flight. And B flight offices were way across the airfield. So I collected the crew together and said, let's walk round the perimeter track, which we did. Got to the flight office, which was a Nissen hut. And there were a couple of Nissen huts, one of which was a crew room with lockers, and one of which had the front half as the flight commander's office, and the back half of it was the engineering office, where a flight sergeant was in charge of the aircraft maintenance personnel for that particular flight. I should explain that 115 was a big squadron. It had three flights. It was known as a three-flight squadron. Lots of squadrons only had two flights. There were A, B, and C flight. And each of those flights had 10 or 12 aircraft and 10 or 12 crew. So that all in all, 115 probably had about 40 air crews on operation or available for ops at any one time, except in those on leave.
What was the role of the squadron office?
Well, the squadron office carried out all the administrative work, and together with the operations group on the airfield would plan the raids after they'd received information from Bomber Command of how many aircraft they should put up, or maximum effort, or whatever, where the raid was. And the squadron office would have a navigation leader, a bombing leader, a gunnery leader, and a wireless operator leader. And these would individually brief the respective trades on, say, things like bomb load, on
we'll come, that's when
navigation.
You go on a raid, is it?
Yes,
we will come
right.
To that. Now, what about the officer's mess? We haven't talked about this
no.
at all. What was the officer's mess there, and what was the nature of it? I mean, was it another hut? What was the officer's mess like?
The officer's mess was a larger version of a Nissen hut. There was a bar, armchairs, some tattered books, tattered magazines, the bar. Everything revolved around the bar. Stan and I went in there, introduced ourselves to the odd person that we saw there. The first night they were on a raid, so we didn't meet many people. And quite honestly, I hardly went into the officer's mess whilst I was at 115.
It wasn't important. You didn't drink much there.
No, I went out with the crew. If we were not flying or allowed out that particular night, we always went out as a crew, except for Stan, who was elderly and didn't drink very much and wrote letters to his wife and children.
Now, Tell us what a typical night out with the crew would be like, because we're going to look at a typical bombing raid. Well, but we'll do this first. I mean, I know it wouldn't happen straight away, but when you did go out with the crew, what would a night out be?
Well, in the early days, that's before I acquired a car, I'd say, see you down at the, whatever the name of the pub would be, tonight, and they'd say, yeah, okay, Skip.
And that would be in Whitchford? Or would you go further?
No, I never drank in Whitford. I always went into Ely, because there were more pubs, and it was a nicer sort of place, really.
So you'd meet in a pub?
We'd meet in a pub, and it would be full up with air crew and army, land army girls, WAFs, all sorts of people, all drinking and conversing and marvellous, really.
No particular shortage of beer, then?
No, not there. Very flat beer, but no particular shortage of beer. Didn't get drunk, but...
Well, I wanted to ask you about drinking habits. I mean, how much were people drinking, yourself and others?
Well, I'd only started drinking when I was hanging around waiting, you know, after I got back from Canada. I didn't drink until then. And in those days, I drank more then, because we had nothing else to do, than when I was on the squadron. On the squadron, we talked a lot and talked to the girls. I didn't get a girlfriend, but I mean, we talked with everybody and eyed them up. But by and large, and we sang. We sang masses and masses of songs.
I'll come back. So when you say you didn't drink much, we took 2 or 3 pints?
Yes, 2 or 3 pints in the night, yeah. Maybe four.
Would some of them drink more? Because, I mean, some people can drink 8 pints.
I'm sure some people did, but I didn't notice the sort of drunken behaviour you might get today outside bars. And
what about your crew? Did they drink in the same way as you did?
Yeah, more or less. No more, I don't think.
Would you buy in rounds? Or?
Yes, we take it in turns. Like, I would buy three and they'd buy one. I had the money. My now, two gunners...
Sorry,
were always short of money. They gambled. They were very young and cocky, and they thought they knew everything. And they would gamble as soon as they drew their pay. Every 2 weeks, they were paid on Thursday, I think. They would go to somebody's billet, and where a school, gambling school, was set up, and they would play poker. And they'd lose their money. And then they would come round to my hut and say, can you lend us a quid, Skip? And I would. So I was always the sort of bank for the gunners and the wireless op. They always thought they could gamble. And of course, they were gambling with some of the old hands, not just other aircrew. They were gambling with some ground staff who'd been in 20 or 30 years, had learnt their gambling in the sort of Middle East in peacetime and knew what they were talking about.
Now, tell me about the singing in the pubs. I mean, what sort of songs? Who would lead it? Was there a piano? What was going on?
Sometimes there'd be a piano. Sometimes, the singing would start, as I recall, sort of later in the evening, not sort of 7 or 8 or 9, 8, but around about 9, someone would start up, you know, a song. And it wasn't the bless them all sort of songs. They were songs that were particular to aircrew, bomber command, the war, and it was all about, you know, guys getting killed or the chop and things like that. And it was all made a joke. Everything was funny or a joke.
I don't know.
I've got a book somewhere of aircraft, but I knew a lot of songs and a lot of them were terribly rude. I could sing 10 right now. I won't. But they were all about, and sometimes they were about women and sex, and they were very rude, usually, because I don't think many of the guys, you know, were sort of in a relationship with girls, either permanently or, you know, just for a short while. There were lots of men around, there were fewer girls. You know, East Anglia had American bases, and American bases meant, you know, they had larger air crews. They had more ground crew. They had more money. And I think, you know, sort of, they took most of the girls.
Were there games? I mean, was it darts or anything like that?
Oh, yes, there were darts. People played darts. Some people played darts. But mostly we talked. We talked with the crew about things and just talked about anything.
Was there any particular pub you'd go to, or was it just a pub for the night?
I can't recall that. I know, I remember the Lamb, which was a hotel as well as a pub in Ely, but that was sort of posh. You wouldn't sing and shout and use rude words there, but there were lots of other pubs, small pubs, lots of, as all small towns, they all had lots of pubs, mainly beer licenses. Spirits weren't drunk, it was just beer.
And would you pub crawl or stay in one?
Well, no, yes, in fact, we might start at one and then go on to it. Let's go on to the, you know, the Cat and Fiddle or whatever. And then at 10:30, when the pub's shut, we did get, RAF would send Gary's in trucks, and you'd get a lift home, or you'd walk. It was only 2 or 3 miles, just walk home, singing. Charlie Flint, the wireless op, he always managed to pick up a girl, so when we were ready to leave, he disappeared. And he would have a knowing smile on his face the next morning, but I don't know what that meant. I knew nothing about it.
Now, how did you get on with the other officers there? You've talked a lot about the crew, yeah. But what about with the...
Well, I didn't go in the mess very often, and, you know, sort of lots of evenings, there was, nearly every evening, there were some crews flying. So you really didn't get the whole group of officers, air crew anyway, in the mess. You got the medico and the padre, Holy Joe would be there, WAF officers would be there. There would be, if you like, the more sedate members of officer air crew there chatting up the WAF officers and drinking gin or something.
So your relation was more with the crew?
Much
than
more.
Than
crew.
With
I was crew oriented.
So
completely
you're not
and utterly.
So you,
no,
you,
no.
The officers
no, I didn't. I didn't. In fact, even today, although I can name masses and masses of NCOs, I can't name more than one or two of the officers there.
Now, how did they start to prepare you for your first operations?
Well, let me say, having visited the squadron office the next morning, station office, we were told to report to B flight, which was, as I said, the other side of the airfield, and we did. There was this sort of crew room, and my NCOs and Stan went in there and started talking to the crews. I went into the flight office. There was a corporal clerk in the front, and then there was a door into the flight commander's office. Now, flight commanders on Bombercombe in those days were usually squadron leaders. Squadron commanders were wing commanders. You know, it was a pretty big group. I knocked on the door, come! I went in, and there, sitting in front of me, is a tall, lanky individual. He had the fore and aft hat on his head, but instead of wearing it slightly to one side, he had it pulled over each ear, straight down, and looked rather comical. I saluted and said, Flying Officer Hooper, reporting, sir. What? I said, Flying Officer Hooper. Hooper? Yes. Then I noted he was an air gunner, which was most unusual. He said, well, I'm Squadron Leader Morrison. I said, yes, sir. He said, you're in B flight. Yes, sir. He said, what's your name? I said, Hooper. He said, no, no, no. What's your name? Your Christian name. I said, Harry. He said, good God. What's your second name? I said, William. He said, call you Bill. That was my introduction. Call you Bill. I later found out he was had been a KC. He was a barrister who joined up, and he was 40 something, and he'd flown a lot of ops as an air gunner. Most remarkable chap.
And his name is. Do you know his first name?
No.
So Squadron Leader Morrison.
Squadron Leader Morrison, that was.
And what was he like? I mean, he sounds very eccentric.
He was. To me, he was eccentric. He wouldn't pass as too eccentric today, but in those days, you know, I mean, he seemed to me, I mean, God, first of all, here am I going into the flight, and I find that the boss is an air gunner of all things, the lowest form of human life. I couldn't believe it. Like, but he was an excellent chap. I mean, B-flight, you know, had a high morale. He occasionally flew with people. No one wanted him because, A, he was elderly, and they didn't think, you know, his reactions would be fast enough. So he wasn't welcome to fly. Instead of having your own rear gunner, you've got Morrison. God, God, help. But he was an incredible chap. I never knew him. I never saw him in the mess, though I hardly visited the mess. I never met him socially, just at the flight. And he called me Bill.
Which, a bit strange.
Yeah, it was, because I was, most of my crew called me Hoop or Skip. Hardly anyone called me Harry. Even my flight lieutenant Bomhomer called me Skip. I was always Skip, and I was the boss. There was no doubt about that. I made sure I was the boss. I loved it.
I'll come to that when we talk about the flight. Now, could you explain a bit what the crew room was? It was that, who was the crew room for? What was it?
They were for air crew members who, well, you know, because if you weren't flying, you'd have to go to the flight shack every morning. And you'd sit there, read the odd book or magazine, and just chat. Occasionally, the gunners would go out to their aircraft and look at their guns and turrets. Wireless op would go to the aircraft and check over the WT bomb sites. Things were checked, whether they were flying or not.
And would the officers would be in the crew room as well, would they? I mean,
yes, all in the same room. Yeah, yeah. There was no.
What was there in there? Just what sort of seats? I mean,
well, there were just a few chairs and seats, and there were lockers in there for parachutes and flying clothing, because flying clothing was kept there.
And any a wireless or anything or.
I can't remember there being any radio in there. There probably was. I don't know, really.
So what was the next stage?
You see, what happened, if you got there and you weren't flying, you'd hang around till 11-ish, and then the squadron leader, Morrison, would say, OK, chaps, you're stood down. That meant we were free for the day. So back we'd go. They'd go to the mill. I'd go and have some lunch or something. And then I'd go into Ely and go to the cinema, maybe, or I'd do some reading. And then we go out to the pubs in the evening.
Now, what's next then? I mean, you've arrived, you've been introduced to Morrison, or, you know, you're now Bill to him. Anyway.
Yeah.
What happens next?
Well, you just waited to, you know, get a first trip. I did a local familiarisation flight to get to know the local area.
Tell me what, I mean, it's pretty obvious, but explain that.
Well, that, I mean, it was helpful to know the sort of local landmarks. If coming back in, well, any type of visibility, but it was usually pretty poor in the Fens in daylight, and it was awful at night. So we'd do a local familiarisation flight, just to fly around the local area, really, to get to know, you know, if there was a steeple on a church that was particularly helpful in locating the airfield. Airfields had a green light which flashed. Its particular number, code number, or two code numbers, letters, alphabetical letters, so that at night, if you were flying over Wychford, you might see flashing green Abel Charlie or something like that. That changed, of course. You got that change as well. So airfields had green flashing lights. The pundits previously mentioned were red. They were navigational aids. But airfield lights were only on if they were flying.
Now, were you given a Lancaster that was yours?
No,
because I noticed that you only seem to have flown a different one every time.
That's right, and most of the others did. Because of serviceability problems and the fact that there were a lot of crews there, I don't think even the flight commander, well, because our flight commander was a squadron leader, so he didn't have an aircraft and he didn't do much flying. But flight commanders, one of which, I think C-Flight or A-Flight, Squadron Leader Gorry, Bill Gorry, he didn't have his own aircraft. I mean, you flew the aircraft that was serviced on had been allocated. Now, they were allocated in A and B-Flight by the squadron leader, who was a pilot. on seafloor, I don't know who allocated them. I mean, what happened if you were going on an operation, when you went into the briefing room, there will be a blackboard board with names and aircraft, and that was your aircraft.
So that was
under A, B, and C flights. So there was B flight, and there would be, you know, aircraft. KO was the squadron numbers. Roger, flying off the Hooper, and crew. That's it. That was how, and that was it. But we got the aircraft that was serviceable. Certainly as a new member, I did. It may be that some of those longer serving guys, you know, getting towards the end of their tours or something, had a particular aircraft they fancied, but they couldn't always fly it. I mean, they'd be put flying, and maybe the aircraft was being serviced, having a 200-hour check or a 800-hour check or something, so they couldn't use it. They'd have to use whatever was available. Some aircraft were pretty worn out, some weren't. Some were fairly new.
Now, we'll now start with a typical mission. I don't know which mission you remember right. You did an operation over Heinrichshoot,
yeah,
and then over Holmes, well, and Ham. I don't know.
Perhaps I should explain what 115 are doing.
Yeah, that would be, yes, that
really,
would be good.
Because they weren't like the average Bomber Command squadron at that time. 115 was three group. Three group had about 10, 11 squadrons. And at that particular point in time, they were mainly engaged on daylight formation GH bombing.
Now, what's that, GH?
Well, GH bombing system was probably the most accurate bombing system devised during the war. It utilized the G navigational system. But what one got out of this, a particular target would have two beams. It would have an approach bombing lane beam, and it would have a bomb release beam which would intersect that, not at right angles usually. And they had to be selective from the station so that you got a reasonable angle where the one crossed the other if they were, you know, too close together when the inaccuracy was good. And this is where the navigator became king of the aircraft, really. A typical daylight raid for 115 and 3 group would be the group were on, and we flew in what was known as a gaggle. We didn't fly like the Americans did in boxes, which were set up for firepower. The defensive firepower. We flew all at the same height.
Now, I think we'll go right back to the start, which
right.
Probably we'll do on the next reel. So